Aloha, welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. Could a green energy future include more liquefied natural gas? We get the latest on a soon-to-be-released state report. Raising awareness about dyslexia, a University of Hawaii volleyball coach shares his experience from diagnosis to becoming a professional athlete. He shares his story of success while living with a learning disability. And just what the doctor ordered, we explore a path to healing through the soothing sounds of shakuhachi and haiku. And did you know Kauai's shores are hotspots for spying little sandpipers? We highlight the little birds on our Manu Minute. It is Wednesday, October 23rd. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, earlier this year, Governor Josh Green raised the question of whether liquefied natural gas should be more in Hawaii's energy mix. The state's ambitious green energy goals have a 2045 deadline to reduce our dependence on oil. Here with a look at that is HPR's energy and climate change reporter, Savannah Harriman-Polk. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I recall him mentioning this, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. We're starting this up again.
Yes, he turned a lot of heads because liquefied natural gas is a controversial energy resource. It is a fossil fuel, so the way you make it is you cool natural gas down to an extremely low temperature, and that's what makes it easier to store and to transport, and that's how it gets its name, liquefied natural gas. And there has been a lot of debate that's been had across the country as well as here locally about whether or not liquefied natural gas can act as a bridge to get us closer to our renewable goals. And so what we've seen here in Hawaii is that depending on the administration, we've kind of waffled back and forth about whether or not we want to bring this into our energy mix. So former Governor Neil Abercrombie considered it, but his successor, David Ige, was against it. And in that administration, we saw a lot of our biggest, most ambitious climate goals down. And it kind of seemed like we might have closed the door about 10 years ago on liquefied natural gas. But then Green revived the idea this summer.
Right. So do we know why all of a sudden he thought, hey, maybe it should be in the mix?
Well, in his public comments about it, he said, we have to be realistic about what we're trying to achieve. We have these ambitious energy goals. We're still very dependent on oil. It's expensive. Energy costs are high. And after Lahaina, our main utility is in kind of a precarious position. So could liquefied natural gas perhaps attract capital investments into our energy system as well? I spoke with Mark Lick, who is the state chief's energy officer, and he largely echoed those sentiments when I talked to him.
It's definitely not something that I would have wanted to return to that debate, you know, knowing how contentious it was in the past. But the truth of the matter is, I think the governor felt the same way, is that we needed to take the blinders off and just take an objective look at everything that was available to us that actually could improve our transition to a fossil-free, carbon-free environment, affordable, more resilient energy system.
Yeah, I can see why, you know, he's trying to be pragmatic. I mean, the state took a lot of bashing when we were having all the unpredictability with the energy resource after we shut down the coal plant, the AES coal plant. So, yeah.
And so at Governor Josh Green's direction, the Hawaii State Energy Office has been preparing this pretty robust analysis on liquefied natural gas for several months. And he says that that is going to be out by the end of the year. That it was expected this summer, but they keep adding more components to it because it is a really big, complicated question.
So what else are they looking at?
So they're really evaluating three things: cost, carbon emissions, and capital. Can liquefied natural gas lower energy costs? Can it reduce carbon emissions by reducing our dependence on oil? And would it be attractive to different investors? And this part is still a little unclear. We'll see what comes out in that report at the end of the year, to build out our energy system and perhaps support Hawaiian Electric at its dealing with economic uncertainty. And so Glitz says that any recommendations that his office makes in favor of liquefied natural gas really have to make sense on all of those fronts.
We hope that the public will be interested in this issue you know, and enough to take a good look at it, and to do so with an open mind. Let's look at the numbers and let's look at the intent under which it was done, which was to try to bring in capital that could make critical improvements, again, to the grid, the power system, and, you know, into the utility to reduce its liability risk, at the same time that we're able to provide some opportunities to reduce costs of the electricity system for ratepayers, or at least manage those costs, make sure they don't go up, and of course, lower our carbon emissions so that we can continue to work towards this extremely ambitious decarbonization objective.
But a lot of people still have concerns about the idea of increasing the state's import of liquefied natural gas just on its face, even without seeing the report. So the Sierra Club of Hawaii and the climate advocacy group 350 Hawaii have spoken out about it. I spoke to our friend Henry Curtis, the head of the environmental group Life of the Land, which has pushed back against previous efforts to bring in more liquefied natural gas. Here's what Curtis had to say.
For the governor to take a position that we should take our eye off the drive for renewable energy and instead focus on building fossil fuel infrastructure seems to be an unwise policy. Adding liquefied natural gas to the mix would definitely allow the cheaper alternative to come into play. And if LNG were cheaper than oil or petroleum, then theoretically, it could make some sense. However, we are pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into building a renewable energy future where renewable energy is now cheaper than fossil fuel. So the idea that we would take our eye off the cheaper and long-term solution to build a bridge to nowhere involving LNG is crazy in our opinion.
And another really tricky thing about this question is timing, right? So even if the state's analysis supports liquefied natural gas and says it's cleaner, it's cheaper, it'll attract capital, the timing is still really tricky because we have that mandate to be essentially fossil fuel free by 2045. So that means ramping up and then completely ramping down our liquefied natural gas use in just two decades. So when I spoke with Lick about this, he estimates that we would need all of the infrastructure to import and use liquefied natural gas up and running by 2033. And then we would, which means we would likely need the first go-ahead that this is the state's new direction as early as next year. And climate analyst Jeff Michelina says that math just probably is not going to factor out.
I think that's the real challenge here. And I think this is why we should take a look at this plan and probably immediately discount it. The timelines required to fit this into this narrow window before we get to 100% renewable is just really unattainable. I mean, we know things sometimes take a little longer in Hawaii, and something as wide scale as this would certainly take years to get approved and get through the permit process. This isn't a matter of simply swapping out one fuel for another, you know, putting unleaded in your car. This means entirely new infrastructure. You essentially need new generators to burn the fuel. You need infrastructure for shipping to bring in the liquefied methane, all sorts of changes and investments that are required. And to try to pay those investments off in such a small window would really be a Herculean task.
Right. So one of the selling points of liquefied natural gas is that it's a cleaner fossil fuel, but it is still a fossil fuel. And that's the main point that people who are concerned are raising, right, is are we going to try to really invest more infrastructure for fossil fuels while also investing extensively in renewable efforts? Can't we just double down on renewable efforts and try to get that to our end game? And Mark Lick was clear when I was speaking with him where it's not, they're not saying in the preparation of this report that this is the state's new strategy or this is the only thing that they're evaluating. He said that they're taking an agnostic view, looking at fuels to see if they might be helpful. But at the end of the day, the state is clear-eyed in its goal to be fossil fuel free by 2045.
Well, you can already just tell though, the environmentalists, you know, you've got the hair up on their back, right? Like, no, absolutely not. But then you have to think, well, what else is happening with, you know, wind power and wave power? And are we on track to really develop all those? And if it takes an awful long time to get those ramped up, yeah, you just wonder about what else we need to be putting our, where else we need to be putting our eggs as opposed to just one basket so
right.
fast.
Right. And the something that Mark Lick and Jeff Michelina and other environmentalists agree on is the states may have, the islands may have different strategies. We have different grids, so there may be a different mix that we need to meet those goals depending on what those grids look like on other islands.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you.
That was HVR's Savannah Harriman-Pote checking in with the Energy Office on its report on liquefied natural gas.
The news and music you hear on HPR are supported in part by nearly 200 local organizations that choose to reinforce their brand with us. Mahalo to Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and PAXA. They believe, just as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our underwriters at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Creating a more accessible and inclusive world for people with dyslexia is the goal of designating October as Dyslexia Awareness Month. Dyslexia affects about 20% of people in Hawaii, according to the Hawaii branch of the International Dyslexia Association. October is also an opportunity to celebrate those who have the learning disability and have excelled, like Nick Costello. Costello grew up on Oahu and graduated from Assets School in 2007. He played volleyball at the University of Hawaii and then went on to play professionally in Europe. Today, he's an assistant coach for the UH Wahine volleyball team. Costello recently shared his story with The Conversation's Russell Subiono.
When were you first diagnosed with dyslexia?
I want to say it was sometime in my fourth grade year. Up until then, learning in general, specifically like reading and I mean math kind of as well, but you know, math back then is on the easier side. Mm-hmm. But it was more so I think reading that kind of stood out where it was a little bit of a struggle. And then it just, you know, got to the point where it was like, okay, like let's see, look under the hood kind of thing, you know. And then I want to say it was around my fourth grade year when I got tested, or maybe even third grade year, and then going into fourth grade, kind of dealt with it. So I'd say probably around like that third, fourth grade years when I got tested and diagnosed.
What kind of challenges did you encounter before the diagnosis that kind of maybe made your parents think you should be tested?
It was all just in the classroom. I think the reading, especially for me personally, I think one of the things we would do like the popcorn reading, mm-hmm. where like someone would read and then popcorn and it would come to me. And every time I got popcorn to me, it would just be like, where are we? Like I was like pages behind everybody else, just like following along. And I think because I like struggled to follow along, especially when it came to the reading, I just kind of like checked out, you know what I mean? My attention just wasn't there and school in general wasn't my cup of tea. I was always into athletics and sports. That's where my mind was at, just waiting for that recess bell to ring and let's go do my thing. But up until then, it was just kind of a struggle in the classroom. So obviously, you know, that's going on. The teachers aren't happy with me when that's the case. We're like, man, every time we popcorn you, man, you don't know where we are and this and that. So guarantee it came up in like parent-teacher conferences and whatnot. And obviously I had conversations with my teacher as well, but it was never something that I was deliberately doing. It was just something where I was like, I don't know where we are right now in this reading. But I think for me personally, thinking back, that's where I always kind of felt a little bit more isolated in a sense, where it's kind of like you felt the eyes kind of like, man, like how come we don't know like what page we're on or whatnot? It's kind of like that. And then obviously there's other instances throughout learning where it kind of popped out.
And then when you did get the diagnosis, what did your parents and you do afterward to kind of adapt or change so that you could have some success at where you are?
I'm super grateful for my parents. They sacrificed a lot to put me in a position where I could find my path to then lead to me being where I am right now. But that was, you know, doing the research and understanding like, okay, like he's dyslexic, what's the next steps? And then we found that Assets is a school that specializes in gifted and dyslexic individuals. And it's not the cheapest school. So, you know, they sacrificed a bunch to send me there just because we felt like that was the best option. Once I got to Assets, you know, it was first just kind of going through all these different, I guess, like mini tests or just kind of ways of learning. And then teachers were able to find out what type of learner I was and how I learned. And then they were just breaking that thing down to me. And then the style of teaching was then a little bit more specific to me. Where before it's like, you know, Waldorf, it's just like, okay, this is how we learn. And if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. And I was one of those that didn't get it. I was left behind. Yeah. Where at Assets, it was a little bit more smaller class sizes, a little bit more detailed of how each individual learned, and the teacher knew how to kind of deliver messages and material to each one. So for me, that was the biggest thing when it came to learning, because, you know, before it was pretty discouraging going in the classroom and I just kind of dreaded being in there. My attention would just be somewhere else. And then after going to Assets and then kind of having this different type of breakdown and delivery of learning, it started to become a little bit interesting because I started to get it, right? Like they kind of showed me like, oh, like instead of this, like try this way. And then I was like, oh, like that makes sense now. And then once I started to get it, then I wasn't as checked out. It was a little bit more like, oh, I can come to class and like I'm actually like retaining some information or understanding some information. And then I just start to build from there. And then obviously, as you get older, there's different challenges, you know, from the curriculum and whatnot. And, you know, with each different challenge was a new obstacle and a new way of finding out how to, you know, navigate through that. But I mean, my teachers were huge when it came to that. And I just noticed from the academic standpoint, things became a lot more interesting. And again, I think just like the delivery and the breakdown that I was getting then, it was just sticking. And then once it stuck, it was like, oh, okay, like I was told to do it like this, but now I'm getting told to do it like this and it's making more sense. So then I was like, okay, like let's continue this. And obviously I still wasn't like the best student or anything like that, but just the material making more sense and then finding like these little tricks that I guess you could say were a little like, you know, unconventional, but it got me to understand the material and then, you know, apply it. And I wasn't the greatest test taker, but you know, like understanding how to do, like, here's a problem. How do I get to that problem and different things? And obviously I understood like what was my strengths. Like math was probably the lowest on the totem pole when it came to my strengths. And then reading and writing, obviously I wasn't the best reader, but you know, I think that being dyslexic, you're just naturally a little bit more creative in my opinion. And when it came to writing assignments, I think that's where I really thrived because it was, okay, here's three pictures and like all different pictures, like a sequence, like write a story about it. Like, oh, okay. And then my creativity could just go, you know what I mean? But I think from getting a little bit more comfortable and tapping into that creative side of writing, it kind of tied into the reading. So then that made reading a little bit more easier in a sense for me because I could back it up with the writing. So that was always kind of cool because the school part was a little daunting to me. So I feel like just being in a system that was like, go to college, go to school, go to college was kind of like, all right, like, yeah, I want to go play sports in college. Yep. So I knew I had to go there, but it wasn't as pressing. It was more of like this, like, oh, let's just learn and like figure out how we learn. And then like whatever we decide to do from there, like we can attack that.
I know that you played volleyball collegiately at the University of Hawaii. I know that you played professionally in Europe. So I'm kind of curious as to the tools that you were able to acquire in this period. Did that set you up to achieve this kind of success, either to be able to go to college, to be able to go overseas? How did these tools kind of impact you as an adult?
I think it's a mixture of my situation in school and academics and then also sports. Like, I'm pretty sure my first word was ball. And after that, it was just sports. It was like soccer, baseball, basketball. Volleyball is like the last thing on my list, but, you know, look where it took me. So, but I think it was a mixture of those two where it's like you have being dyslexic and like, you know, operating in the classroom, there's one side of adversity. And then sports, you're going to get a bunch of adversity. And like you being a coach, we say like, you know, whatever sport you're playing, for me being volleyball is just a vessel for life lessons. And I think, you know, in school, it's kind of the same. You're just going to learn a bunch of life lessons and just figure out how, you know, just navigate through. You know, you're going to get hit with speed bumps in life and sometimes you're going to have to take some detours. It's not always going to be this straight, perfectly paved road. And that's okay. I think a lot of times people are only wanting to be on that paved road. And when they get, you know, a little sidetracked, they got to go somewhere else. They get a little bit, you know, they get a little bit tense, they tighten up, they don't know how to operate. But for me, you know, that was my whole life on both ends. Cause in sports, I'm getting challenged, in the classroom, I'm getting challenged. I'm not trying to say that people without dyslexia aren't getting challenged, you know, in the classroom and on the court as well. But for me, it was just a little bit different in a sense, you know, but I think the adversities and learning how to handle them because, you know, whether it was my parents or my teachers, when it came to, you know, studies, there's a lot of tough times. There's a lot of times where I was just like, man, I can't do this. But, you know, I had good support system that just said like, no, you can just, you know, take a step back. Let's look at it with a different lens and attack it a little bit differently and just, you know, keep finding a way. And in sports, you know, it's all about being persistent. And I think in life, it's all about being persistent because things aren't going to go your way. And, You know, I think the ones that make it far and are successful, the ones that have thicker skin and understand that things aren't going to always happen your way, but it's a matter of just kind of letting things go, making the best of every situation, reframing it, and just finding a way to keep going. Luckily for me, I had sports as my motivator. It was very simple. It's like, you want to play, you have to have a certain GPA, which means you got to go to class. So for me, that was like, got it. I really want this. So I got to do all of this in order to put myself in a position to do what I really love and what I'm really passionate about. Yeah, I got tested a bunch and it was just a little bit of kind of figure it out. It's not one way to figure it out, but you know, find your way of figuring it out. And, you know, it was really cool in those situations where it was like, okay, hey, you got to read 2 different books and turn in a 10-page paper in a week. I'm like, oh. So, you know, I was able to lean back on what all the tools I learned from assets and just, you know, find my own way of, you know, knocking it out and then, you know, getting things done. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, it was kind of both those vessels of adversity that kind of just aligned. And then having the support system that I had, you know, you jumble that all together and, you know, that's where I am right now.
What would you say is the most important thing for parents if they do have a child with dyslexia, or schools if they do have students with dyslexia? What's the most important thing that they can do to help them succeed?
Well, first and foremost, I think one is just identifying it, right? You look back at me being in like first and second grade, maybe in a little bit of third grade, it was kind of just like, okay, like he just, you know, not getting it. Like maybe he will, maybe it will. But then once we found out that I was dyslexic, it was like, oh, okay, that makes more sense. Like he has a learning difference. You know what I mean? Like he learns differently. And then from there, like I said, like my parents just kind of, okay, well, we have a kid that's dyslexic. Okay, what can we do now? Because he's not doing what he needs to do here. Like, what can we do for him? And that's why I love my parents, because, you know, they found whatever way to put me in a position to succeed. But I think the biggest takeaway, like when I look back, is like, man, like, especially when you're younger, it's so easy to compare, right? Mm-hmm. You kind of, everyone falls victim to comparing, even now as adults, right? Like you're always going to compare people to everybody. And then now I feel like even more so with this generation of social media, like it's all about like, oh, but like, if I don't make this post because everybody else is making this post, if I don't make this post, like, oh, I feel like I'm on the bottom, like I'm a loser or whatever else may be. You know what I mean? Like your self-confidence just goes down the drain. But I feel like the quicker that I was able to just kind of take a step back and be like, all right, like I can't compare myself to anybody, regardless, even if you're dyslexic or not, like whatever you're going through, like you shouldn't compare yourself. Like everyone's your own person. But me from a academic standpoint is like, all right, like once I kind of got over that idea of like, I want to learn like all my other friends, and I embraced like, okay, I'm not going to learn like them and I'm just going to be a little bit different. You're going to go this way, I'm going to go this way, but hey, we'll meet each other at the end. You know what I mean? Once I embraced that, yeah, it was just way easier for me. And then it kind of made it a little bit more of a, you know, tied into my identity. It kind of like, I grew up a lot once I embraced that mentality, and even moving it into, you know, sports. Like I think difference sometimes can be a bad thing, but I look at difference as a good thing, especially being a coach. I go into a gym and recruit and I see 1,000 athletes that are all just right here. And you see that one that kind of jumps the needle, spikes the needle a little bit. And you're like, okay, that's going to grab your attention. So I think throwing that whole idea of comparing and like, you know, once you throw it out the door and just like, yeah, I'm different and like, I'm all about that and let's just continue to ride. I think that mentality was really huge, but everybody's a little bit different. You walk down the street, you're going to see 10 different people. Most likely we're all going to be thinking a little bit differently. You know what I mean? But as you get older, you start to mature and you understand that, oh, that's life. And you get people that are older telling you these nuggets when you're younger, and you're younger and you don't want to hear it because you think you know it all. And then you get older, you're like, oh yeah, like, they're right. I could have just listened to that and jumped the gun a little bit more. That was like a cheat code.
That was Wahine assistant volleyball coach Nick Costello. He was talking about his journey with dyslexia with HPR's Russell Subiono. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Hawaii. Today we're taking you to the Friendly Isle, where a local singer made her island proud. The vocalist won the title of Miss Molokai in the 1960s. At the Miss Hawaii pageant that year, she sang Moon River as her talent, captivating an audience of thousands. From there, a highly successful musical career began. She was awarded the Nahoku Award for Best Female Vocalist 5 times throughout the 70s and 80s, guest starred in the original Hawaii Five-O, and performed weekly at Waikiki's International Marketplace from 2011 to 2014. She also sang in concert at HPR's own Atherton Studio, and audiences may know her from a popular country album where she sang standards in both English and Olelo Hawaii. Take a listen to her version of the song Crazy. Think you might know this mystery woman? Well, call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NāreitHawaii.com.
Music as Medicine, a new University of Hawaii at Manoa study will look at just that. And if you're 55 or older, you could qualify for a guided meditation session while listening to the sounds of shakuhachi, a Japanese bamboo flute. The pair behind the research are Jane Lee and Katsumi Tokimoto. Lee is an associate professor of social work at UH, and Tokimoto worked in geriatric and end-of-life care for 4 decades before returning to pursue a master's in social work. The question they're trying to answer, do the sounds of shakuhachi combined with meditation and haiku writing promote the physical and mental health of our kupuna? The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Lee and Tokimoto. Tokimoto starts us off.
Mother's background is that she was born here but does not remember living here. She was raised in Hiroshima, and so when she was 15, that's when she experienced the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. So I became very interested in that. When she passed away, I started to really begin research on trauma, and then that led to healing. And growing up in a Japanese household, I think I was really influenced by the tunes. She played the koto since I was born. So I was very in tune with the vibration of the Japanese harp. So I think what happened was I want to really continue that vibration of healing as a service to people. And that led me to helping people in hospice care. And I found through studies I did through education foundations at the University of Hawaii, really interesting results. Although I had been doing it before on my own, when there's data collected, that's when I think I became aware of what the power of vibration, sound. So this is how we came to the idea of this research project. My background also has been studying meditation. So it's been maybe over 50 years. I started when I was 8 years old at a local temple, and it was something that I really immersed myself in, wishing I could help people. And so putting that together with Shakuhachi, I think it's a perfect opportunity right now.
Yeah, and maybe Jane, chime in with what interested you about this work.
Katsumi's experience and her expertise means so much to the community here in Hawaii because she really brings the cultural perspective. And a lot of people think that, you know, treatment or medicine are the best way to get healthier. But I just want to emphasize that there are many other innovative and also cultural approaches in terms of healthcare approach, right? So I think this approach is really meaningful, and I can't wait to see the findings because we're at the very initial stage of really scientifically understanding whether or not this approach is effective. So I just wanted to put that out there that, you know, moving away from the Western medical approach, we should consider some of the alternative culturally sensitive interventions when it comes to improving the health and well-being of our older adults.
I did also want to ask what the program itself will consist of.
In the first session, I ask everyone to create a preferred haiku name or pen name so that we can ensure confidentiality of the participants. And then we will go over breath work with aloha and using the breath connected with our na'au, or what I say is we let go of our what we learned in school. We take off our thinking caps and bring it down to the tummy. And down at the na'au, we turn on a light. And this is where we have the ki or the chi or the prana. And we practice breath work. And it's gentle breath work. And we talk starry. And I connected with the Japanese concept called kokoro, which means heart and mind. And then I will go over the sound of connecting and synthesizing everything in meditation. And interestingly, this meditation is different from maybe traditional because firstly, I have developed a style of connecting the shakuhachi, which is made of bamboo, with nature. So I connect with nature and what we discuss in the session. And the meditation portion may be a couple of minutes because I feel if we can connect with nature spontaneously, that is pretty much instant. And then I will go over the haiku. Usually it's connected to the traditional style, which is connecting the kigo or seasonal word or seasonal concept in the haiku, and then sort of a contrasting word. And I have some examples. So this one was composed by an adult day program as a collective, at home with family, pounding the steaming mochi and drinking sake. And so what I do in the session is really kind of changing the rules to meet with our local tradition. And so we really don't have winters or clear seasons. So I ask people to reflect on their life experiences instead. Here is another haiku that's reflecting on a life experience. Climbing to the top, small kid time, sit on a branch. Oh, juicy mangoes. we are hadashi. So that was added. Hadashi means barefoot. In Hawaii, mangoes grow at a certain season. So in a way, this is sort of following the haiku rules of Kigo. All the haiku we do are deeply reflective. So here is one. Thoughts fall gracefully in my stillness to the ground like leaves of a tree.
Oh, I love that one.
This was composed by a participant. Here's another one. In Japanese, Ware shinobu koki no michinori meian no. It means in my reflection through the shadows and bright light in my 70th year. So this kupuna composes haiku through the meditation. And it's really a profound, reflective haiku. The kupuna really enjoy these reflections, and they report feeling more focused, more empowered even. And here's some reports by some kupuna. I further my consciousness during meditation and connect with nature with rhythm and flow. I am more aware of my breath and able to relax. Every sound is so rich. Meditation allows you to almost taste the shakuhachi like spiritual food.
When you lead these sessions, when people compose these haiku, how does that make you feel that you've been able to, you know, impact them to that degree that they describe your shakuhachi playing as being able to taste it almost?
I feel like melting. It feels really good.
And you shared just some of the most wonderful experiences you've had playing shakuhachi for various audiences, be them human or animal. So would you just be able to, maybe for our listeners, share a couple of the really standout experiences that you were able to see the effects of that practice?
I think when I hear people calling, it could be even animals, something draws me to them. And so one time at the university, there was a real big commotion. I went to it. It was ducks and ducklings stuck in the pond. And then I overheard that they would die overnight. And there were planks put there and people were trying to feed them, but the mother duck could not steer the ducklings up. And I thought, okay, I have to try this. So I took my shakuhachi out and within seconds, they formed a line and waddled up the plank and became as if it was easy. And so someone was there and a student, he started crying. And I think, you know, if we can do non-traditional things and really try, because I'm not sure why, and I would like to apply this and have data recorded. Another really important experience is volunteering at hospices. And when I play the shakuhachi, many are in, you know, at their end of life. And what they do is I notice they express their final wishes, their pain subsides. And I have had families calling me saying that they have never seen their parent maybe sing before. They sing along with me. And really, it's an honor to be able to do this. And so having this applied in research, I think, is a really key thing. Otherwise, I just call it miracles. And I say the word healing because to me it means making one whole. So to improve the quality in life of kupuna or any being, I think it's really an opportunity to apply it with science.
And I think that offers a good opportunity, Jane, maybe to talk a little bit about study design and some of the choices that were made for this upcoming experiment. So why focus on kupuna, for example?
I think the question of why kupuna is really critical. So one thing I really wanted to note is, you know, as everybody knows, the number of older adults are increasing, right, very dramatically. And this is true for our own state, Hawaii. And that really brings a lot of opportunities and challenges at the same time. So, for example, we're seeing a lot of kupuna, especially in light of the COVID-19 pandemic, who have been struggling with mental health challenges and cognitive health challenges. And we believe that kupuna, they need a lot of help in terms of healthcare, but number one, maybe they're experiencing financial challenges to really seek appropriate care and treatment. Number two, they know that, you know, based on their cultural preferences, the hospital setting may not be the best option, right? So I think just thinking about our vulnerable older adults and their healthcare need, this approach of mindfulness meditation can open up a lot of new opportunities for them because, number one, it's so easy to access, right? If a lot of community centers out there serving our kupuna population can adopt this model and implement it for our older adults in the communities, I believe that long term we'll see a lot of improvement in terms of their health and well-being, but also a lot of cost saving, right, outcome. So there's this both micro to macro level benefits in terms of really serving the kupuna population. So I just want to elaborate that, yes, serving our kupuna is so critical.
Yeah. Is there anything else that each of you wanted to add or things you're thinking about or hope that people listening will take from this?
Oh, thank you for inviting us and allowing us to share. Can I share a couple more haiku?
Please.
So here's one. A soulful journey, akahai transforming human existence. Another one is, peace, where are you? Let go, open your heart. I'm here, come find me. So we really have a great time, and the time goes really quickly. It's about an hour of breath work, talking about aloha and a Japanese concept that's equivalent. And then we do a couple minutes of meditation, and then about half an hour of composing haiku and talking story. At the very end, I ask everyone to reflect, and I have written out surveys or questionnaires. And from that, you will be able to impact the future research and hopefully maybe apply this with policies to help apply non-pharmaceutical ways of helping people. And I would really appreciate if everyone could spread the word about this research.
That was Jane Lee and Katsumi Takimoto talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. They were discussing a study looking at the link between shakuhachi music and the health of older adults. The plan is to begin sessions in November at the Susanna Wesley Community Center. We will have a link to the group's flyer on the conversation page of our website after the show.
This weekend on The Real Deal, join me, Seth Marco, as we give a good long listen to one of the most underrated jazz musicians of all time, tenor saxophonist Warren Marsh. That's Saturday and Sunday from 8 to 10 on HPR 1, Warren Marsh. I'm the real deal.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
For today's Mono Minute, we've got a little sandpiper for you whose rattling call gives you a clue to its name. With calls from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and the Zeno Canto, here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Akekeke, also known as ruddy turnstones when you're not in Hawaii, are medium-sized sandpipers. They're about the size of a mina bird. You can often see them foraging in small flocks, usually along rocky shorelines, but also in mudflats, fields, and lawns. Our birds in Hawaii are in their drab winter plumage, which includes mottled brown backs and white breasts, with a very noticeable black bib pattern below their chin. Their bright orange legs set them apart from other shorebirds you might see. Also, if you look closely, you can see a slight upturn in their bills, which, as their English name implies, seems to help them turn over stones in search of insects and crustaceans. Their Hawaiian name, Akekeke, is similar to their call, which sounds a bit like kekekeke. See if you agree. By late April and May, you might notice that most akekeke have molted into their breeding plumage so they can be more attractive to the opposite sex. They have a beautiful black and ruddy or red-brown pattern of feathers on their backs and striking black and white patterns on their face and breast. Our akekeke make a non-stop migration across the northern Pacific to Alaska, a flight which likely takes them 3 to 4 days. Like many shorebirds, they spend the summer on breeding grounds high up in the Arctic to take advantage of abundant food resources during the long Arctic summers. The males and females arrive at about the same time, set up very exclusive territories in the tundra to keep out other akekeke, and they build their nest in a scrape on the ground. Both parents feed and care for up to 4 keiki in the nest, and if resources that summer are good, and they manage to escape predation by foxes or jaegers, the juveniles will get together in small flocks to make their first trip to Hawaii by late August, with most adults arriving a week or two before that. Our akekeke are considered to be an indigenous species, meaning that they're found naturally here as well as other parts of the world. The worldwide population size was recently estimated to be about 500,000 birds, and unlike many of our other native bird species, populations of akekeke appear to be relatively stable. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, devoted to conserving the unique flora and fauna of Hawaii Island. More about giving at friendsofhakalauforest.org.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the woman behind the microphone of many popular songs, blending country and Hawaiian music. Raised on Molokai, she pivoted a pageantry title into a successful singing career, recording 28 albums. Our singer performed throughout the islands, as well as in Las Vegas, Japan, and New York's Carnegie Hall. She was also part of a group called the Local Divas, along with singers Aloyal Gardner, Carol Kai, and Nohelani Cipriano. Our Mystery Diva performed for PBS Hawaii's Nameli series in 2007, and in March of this year, they brought her back for a discussion in live performance. And the name of the singer we're talking about? Why, Melvin Leet, of course. We'll let a rendition of Lahaina Luna play us out. But first, a shout out to our winner today, who is a huge Melvin fan, who says he's seen her perform over 30 times. Scott Scooter of Ma'alaya, Maui, thank you. You are our winner today, and thank you for being a sustaining member and fan of HPR. If you have an idea for a quiz, please write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I am going to the island of the valley, to Lahaina. Lahaina Luna.
Well, we're out of time, but up tomorrow we plan to take a closer look at the longline fishing industry. Got a story you'd like to share? Call our talkback line and record something, 808-972-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our show as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.
Maui, no Kauai, and I agree that Maui.